Dr. Cosell is a professor in the Peace and Cultural Studies Department at UC Berkeley. And her specialty is cross-cultural communication. But she does so many things. Take me 10 minutes to do this. She's Honorary Counsel Monic Madagascar. She was chairman of the programs at International House in Berkeley, past president of the Richmond Rotary, vice president of the United Nations Association of the East Bay, and most recently, the State Department has contacted her through the Health and Bureau of Internet of Education and Cultural Affairs to coordinate the Fulbright Visiting Scholars Program. So Lillian's just never stops. She's amazing. Okay, so we have a very special program. This is in cross-cultural communication. Let's clap really loud, see if we get that audience in here, okay?
So thank you very much, Dorothy, for the introduction. And I'm really privileged, and I thank you very much for inviting me for the opening of your Summer Forum 2016. And I love the title of Towards a Just World, because I think that what I'm going to talk about, the cross-cultural communication, really kind of is a way to get to a peaceful world, to a just world. So thank you very much for inviting me to be here. So I am going to start with stories. So we have to use our imagination a little bit here. So it's 1944, obviously World War II at that time, and the GIs are in England. They are based there. And they indicated that the young British ladies, there was some problem, and they were loose women, or easy, I would say. And while the young British women said, "Oh my goodness, those GIs, they are rascals, they are hooligans." Okay, so what's happening? So because of that, the famous anthropologist Margaret Mead was invited to do a little research as to what was happening. And, you know, she did her research, and very interestingly, this is what she said. You know, the love approach is driven by a number of steps, but these steps are subject to cultural differences and cultural variation. And in England, one must go through a long series of points before you get to the kiss on the mouth. And the kiss is not far from the final, the ultimate stage. But in the U.S., in contrast, the kiss on the mouth is among the first steps. And therefore, when the GIs begin their romantic scenario with U.S. rules, I would call their U.S. rules, and kissing the young women on the mouth, the British young girls only had two alternatives, either to flee, to run away, or to accept. So that was the solution, or the explanation, I should say, to that particular cross-cultural encounter. So it's a case of kisses and tears. Okay, I'm going to give you another story. So let's this time transport ourselves to Norway. So this is the story, and these are all true stories, obviously, happens in a bus, in a Norwegian bus, and there are benches. Any of you have been to Norway by any chance? Okay, so you probably might have a sense of what I'm going to explain. So there are seats on in a bus, and there are two people seated on the bench. You know, there are benches in the bus. And one person, with a woman with a veil, comes in the, aboard the bus, and she sits on the bench. So one of the person leaves. Okay, so what's going on? Either in the Norwegian minds or in the women with a veil mind, what do they think? So, you know, the woman probably thinks, oh, my God, my goodness, must be my veil, because one person just stood and just left. And but this is what's happening in this particular case. In Norway, space is regulated. And on a bench, only two people sit there. So that's the protocol of that particular culture. So three people is too much. So they just stood up, one person stood up, because that's just the norm of that particular incident. It's politeness. It's kind of a distance, a cultural grammar, if you like. So, again, a different kind of story. But this one, I don't know if you've seen this, because this was something very recent. There was an outrageous food scandal that went viral on the web. And this incident enraged the Italians. So it was called the Carbonara Gate. Okay, carbonara, some of you might know, you know, it's a nice Italian dish which has to be done a certain way. Otherwise, it can be a total disaster. But there was a French program on TV which showed people, you know, they also advertise for products. So they were advertising for the Italian Barilla pasta. And so they wanted to have an Italian cooking demonstration. And so they wanted to do a carbonara dish. And so, you know, they had they used farfalle pasta. I guess those are the bowtie pasta. And so they also had pancetta, I guess it's called, and then they boiled it and then put it there and then prepared the dish right there. And then, oh, this was a cause for great dispute and great outrage from the Italians. First of all, do you use farfalla pasta to use for carbonara? And the most disgusting thing from the Italian point of view was, do you even boil pancetta? Is that the way to do that? And then to mix it together right there and then. So everything went viral on social media. So the French had to take out the particular YouTube clip regarding this. And the Italians found it extremely offensive. And there was a verbal dispute in Italian, in French, of how could they dare. But you know, like for example, for the French too, if you call a baguette, and it has more than salt, yeast, and flour, for them it's not a baguette. But same with me, I'll tell you a story from Madagascar. So we have this kind of donut, which is very similar to a Chinese donut. You know, we are an island, so we are at the crossroad of trade. So, you know, everything I thought was so unique to Madagascar, I'm shocked to find out that, wow, these are Chinese or these are the Portuguese. The Portuguese discovered, and they put that between quotes, Madagascar. But in any case, so I was so excited. I made this donut thing, and then the Chinese teacher of the piano teacher of my daughter, I wanted to offer it to her, so she looks at it and then she tells me, but where are the sesame seeds? So again, you know, like, and I was offended, she was offended, and again, you know, it's just a sesame seed story, but that's what it does. So food level, I'll give a couple more examples. This is now in Switzerland. So you see, it's any countries really where cultural differences make a great big difference. So Switzerland suspended the citizenship process for the family of two teenage Muslim young boys who refused to shake the hands with female teachers. They were just 14, 15, you know, high school kids. And actually, I've noticed it myself, you know, some women do not shake men's hand and vice versa. So in this case, Switzerland decided to suspend it. They were in the process of applying for citizenship. And so this became a big case of religious freedom, and they had to get the expertise of legal opinions, and it's not resolved to this date. And one last example I'd like to mention is like the use of different things in different cultures. So I would like to show this next slide here. So this was about a year and a half ago. My husband and I we were in Houston, Texas, and went to the art museum there. And there was a big exhibit of gold artifacts from the Ghanaian society called Akan, the Akan Society. So wonderful, amazing, big, solid gold, all kinds of artifacts. But then this particularly caught my attention. They were watches. And so wonderful, big pieces watches. So I look at them and I was shocked because there was no mechanism. It was just like, you know, watches the way they were, and they were gold. And so I was kind of puzzled. So I went to, I asked the docent, you know, like, these don't have mechanisms. They're just there. And they say, yeah, you know, during colonization period, you know, the British colonized Ghana. And the local people, the Akan in this case, you know, saw that the British, you know, were always looking at the watch. Time 40, time to travel, time to do this, time to do that. And whereas, you know, in the society is rather loosely time, you know, you do things when things happen, when there are special ceremonies, et cetera, et cetera. So what it is that the royalty took the watch as a symbol of power, but they used it differently so that it's not only to show wealth because it was solid gold, but then, you know, like, I have the power, as you can tell by this watch. That's why they did not have a mechanism. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And very quickly, I do even at the non-gestural level, let's suppose we are attending an American meeting or a Western meeting, or actually many meetings in countries which have the same protocol. You know, if I kind of, we have a meeting and I kind of scratch my head, I think we would understand that as, oh, the person is thinking and giving some time, is thinking about whatever the solution or whatever the problem is. But if you are in Japan, the scratching of the head while you are having a meeting means that you don't want to give a formal decision, you don't want to appear too decisive, because that will bring a little sense of shame, that will bring a little loss of face. So by scratching your head, you are making the people know that, oh yeah, I'm with you, I'm waiting for your consensus, I've not made the decision yet, so let's continue the conversation. Just like in Korea, if if you say yes, yes does not mean yes, and probably you've even encountered that in many other cultures. Because if you say yes, if here I tell you, you know, Dorothy is asking me, do you want to give this presentation? I say yes. So yes confirms that yes, indeed, I'm going to come and I'll be here. Whereas in some other culture, if you say yes, in Korea, for example, it means, oh, yeah, yeah, I heard you, but and I heard that you are inviting me, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to come. I think about it, I heard it, and we'll see what's going to happen.
Can I interrupt you for just a second?
Oh, because of the microphone?
Yeah. I'll get much better sound if
I speak from here.
Yeah, and then the mic stays at the same place. Is that okay? Could you do that?
Okay, but I need to.
I'll be glad to work your computer.
Okay, great.
There you go.
The technician has spoken. Thank you. Okay, so, but then when I need to move the
slides,
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. So I think I gave all of these examples and quite a few of them to just tell you that there are diversity of meanings in cultures, and hence, you know, the title that they have. So either you come to someone, you know, with the olive branch, or that can be seen sometimes as you're brandishing the sword, although unintentionally. So that's what we are going to talk about. So in order to illustrate this, I'm going to actually talk one last time in terms of example about a merger. And this was a merger of the French company Renault and the Swedish company Volvo. So two car companies, and it had nothing to do with their expertise. You know, they wanted to do this merger. It took 3 years to put things together. The revenues were going to be $40 billion with this wonderful merger, but then it just took three months and everything collapsed. So what happened is again something very simple. It was just the clashing of cultures of companies. So of course, you know, there are languages, there are language differences, but I think the most important thing in this case was that, you know, the Swedish have a more informal flow of information, whereas the French, which is more centralized, have a more centralized structure, have a more formal flow of culture. So things are very hierarchic. So when the Swedes always wanted to have a consensus, because it's very important to be inclusive and have everybody's input, for the French, that was just too much, because then they perceived the Swedes as weak. And whereas for the Swedes, the French were just so dictatorial, you know, just imposing things, you know, in an arbitrary fashion. So, you know, that was a big disaster. But the French learned about that, and then they eventually wanted to have another merger with Nissan many years later, and that was a success, because this time both the Japanese and the French managed to marry the cultural differences between the two companies. So just to give additional examples, you know, like even lunch breaks can cause problem. That was in the with the Swedish group, because even here, you know, you go to Spain, dinner is at 10. I thought that dinner here was very early, at 5 o'clock. You know, these are just small examples, but it can do or undo cross-cultural communication. So for me, culture makes quite a difference, and this is based on the course that I did for a whole semester at UC Berkeley, because the goal of the course that I teach is, you know, to try to give students the tools, the strategies and technologies with which will allow them to function in a multicultural world. And these days, you know, it's globalization, so boundaries, geographical boundaries are not that important, but certainly cultural differences are. So for this reason, you know, like what I hope to do this morning is to try to develop your curiosity so as not only to appreciate, but really to understand different frameworks, the other frameworks that are out there, and then to kind of rethink our cultural assumptions so as not to make, you know, premature judgment, and to develop basic strategies so that we actually build our own agility, I guess, if that's the word. I think that's a good word, agility, to navigate across cultures. So I would like to ask you very randomly, when I say culture, what comes to your mind, okay?
Paris,
okay.
Paris is a place where these problems are solved by the Bohemians.
Aha.
This is a place It's the capital of the artistic and cultural world, and you have American composers. They go there to learn how to play music.
You have painters go there
to learn how to paint a painting.
That's true.
You have writers who learn how to speak French so they can translate it into French. I married a Bohemian Norwegian girl. We were happy together because we were both rebels against our individual societies, and we accepted the Bohemia as a kind of invisible culture all its own that drew in contributions from Spaniards like Pablo Picasso, who in turn brought in Africa with his African imitations. And the composers like Satie, who were influenced by American.
Absolutely,
yeah. That's a place that I think we should think about.
Culture.
Especially because that is the cultural center of the world.
Okay, Dorothy, and then I think someone else in the back. Just let's say one word or a sentence at the most. Okay, yeah?
In one word, I'd say language.
Language, very good. Okay, someone else over there? Yeah?
Behavior.
Behavior, language, behavior, mindset that created, that's the source of everything. I think someone else here and then someone else in the back. Yes,
cuisine.
Go ahead. Cuisine, food, yeah. Someone else over here?
Underlying values.
Aha, values. Wonderful. Yeah, we can hear a couple more over here. Yeah.
Family upbringing.
Yes, yeah. How parents, the upbringing of children, absolutely.
Elements that create belonging.
Aha, yes.
I'm going to say San Quentin.
It's San Quentin, but that's all of, you know, I'm going to say that, one more, okay.
Affinity.
Aha. You know.
How about sex?
We just talked about it a little bit earlier, yes. So I'm going to say that all your answers are correct. And I say it because not because I'm a diplomat, okay? It's because they are all correct. So, okay. You know, we are here now. So you've probably heard, you know, I call it the proverbial iceberg. You know, there are many metaphors for culture. You have the onion and then you have the layers. And some people talk about the cultural lenses, you know, in different colors, etc. But I kind of like this, although it's proverbial and everybody knows about it, because I think it's such a nice visuals. So we talked about food, language, cuisine, let's see some of the what was mentioned that's visible because it's at the tip of the iceberg, and usually, you know, the iceberg, you have the tip and that's what we see. And then in the culture model, everything that we can, you know, that has to do with the senses, you know, the touching, the like you said, the painting, the food, visual, everything that we see is up here pertaining to the senses. But the deeper things right here, that the big below the waterline over there, is deeply anchored. And that's, we talked about value. So we talked about parenting practices, for example. Those are deeply anchored and hard to change. But they are below the surface. And what's below there, all of those values, their opinions, those philosophies from down here, those are actually what drives the behavior of what's visible above the water line. So when I say values, these are like you know, what makes you tick, you know, like, is it good, is it bad, you know, gut reactions to things, beautiful, ugly, safe, unsafe, those kind of contrasts. So Yeah, so and let's see, norms also come from the bottom of the bottom of the iceberg. So I am going to tell you something about norm. You know, like because Madagascar was a former French colony, so I have kind of many French examples. So you know, like when the French look at a glass, so you've probably heard this: is it half empty or half full? Right? The French will say, oh, it's half empty. But I'll give you an example. My husband is American, and we were watching the soccer match. It was kind of the finals. And then he comes to me, you know, very excited, and he said, oh, yeah, the Americans are winning. I said, no, I'm looking at the score. I said, no, it's 0-0. Yes, the Americans are winning. Optimism. So I had to share that that example, but I would like to you know, when we get information that's new, that's unfamiliar, how do we process that? So this is again the iceberg, but the French did not like the proverbial iceberg. Different way of thinking, exactly the same thing. But look at the look, it's more linear thinking with the arrows, you know, Cartesian way of thinking. It's exactly the same thing, but, you see, visible but hard to decipher. That's what we were talking, the food, the carbonara, yeast, etc. And then here you have the values starting to be below, more conscious. All of this is invisible, all of the deep. So it's exactly the same thing, but a different look. It's just the way one processes, even the way of thinking in our mind. So that takes us to, let's, can we back up a little bit? Yeah. Let's move. One more, okay. Okay. In any case, before we get to the definition, I wanted to check the how does our brain function. I'm really. I hope that I got the right version of the PowerPoint here, because there should be a picture of our brain on there that I don't see. After that one. Next one. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So this is the brain. So I would like to have a little test. I would like for you to look at what's next. Okay. We stop there. So what do you think this... what do you see?
Ice cream is good.
Ice cream is good. Generally, people will say that that's what we see, right?
Partly good.
Partly good. Aha. We have a little slight differentiation there. Actually, next one. This is actually what that was. And it was kind of, you know, cut in half like this. Can we back up a little bit? And see, we cut it off, and then we thought we saw this. So this is just a taste of the brain. You've never seen this, or some of you have never seen it, but that's what we saw. So what's happening here? Okay, so let's move on over here. So let's do another test. So next one. I would like you to read this, please. No, back up. Yeah. Please, I would like someone to read this, a volunteer. Anybody? Okay.
Research at Cambridge University. It doesn't matter in what order the letters in the word are. The only important thing is that they're...
That the first
letters will... What is it? Attach, right?
I guess there is a P missing there. It should be place. The rest can be a total.
The rest can be a total mess, and you can still read it without a problem. This is because the human mind does not read every letter by itself, but the word as a whole. Amazing, huh?
Okay. Again, you know, that's how the brain functions. So what I would like to say is that diversity, affinity is not something natural. Because the brain function arranges things in that manner, and what it is that we only see what we need to see and what we expect to see and hear, and what we want to see and hear. We kind of anticipate. So, and because the brain, you see, organizes things in a certain fashion. When you get something new, how does it work? So, if we can move on to the next one. Yeah, because we receive information millions of times a day. And it's frequent, random, it's unorganized, it's inconsistent, and they say topsy-turvy. So I kind of put this together because I was trying to find an acronym, and it's FRUIT, you know, so frequent, random, unorganized, inconsistent, topsy-turvy. Perhaps we can find other adjectives. But that's the thing. So when the brain gets all of that information, so how does it process all that new thing? So it does it in two ways, by categories, you know, similar things kind of put together because it's similar to something that you know. And you know, the ice cream is good. It's similar to what we think we know. So, yeah, that's how it organizes it. And then it also organizes it by values. And I mentioned earlier, like, okay, is it good, bad? You know, those gut reaction, contrasting gut reaction. And with that, that's how the brain processes it. And that's why it's only, when two people look at the same thing, it's never the same. You know, one person will see what's my background will be your foreground, and vice versa, your foreground will be my background. So I'm going to show that in a few minutes, because our brain really craves for pattern. That's the way it functions. It organizes things in a certain fashion to kind of make sense of all that frequent, random, incremental information that we get, and it keeps on searching for these patterns. But where is it going to search for the information? Where that, you know, the bottom part of that iceberg, and that's where the values, the norms, the beliefs, the assumptions, that's where it's going. It's not going to go far, but where do you get those? And that's where we are going to get to next. So, okay. Yeah, and then here I said these are just everything that's really hard to move, you know, to change. Opinions, viewpoints, beliefs, the way of thinking, myths, you name it, those things that we hold deep. Okay, someone is laughing here. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. And I think this is what I mentioned. The brain really, it's a wonderful machine, but at the same time, we can be fooled by it if we are not careful. But things go so fast that we don't even have time to process all of that. But this is a slow explanation, kind of slowing the tape a little bit. Okay? All right. Same thing. When we talk, okay, my assumption is that when I'm giving you this information, oh, wow, all of that information is all absorbed wonderfully by each and every one of you. That's our assumption. You give a message to someone. But then, you know, and you know this, even doesn't need to be cross-cultural. Oftentimes you say, oh, that was the person just coming in loops and zigzags. Why didn't they say it directly? I don't understand what they are talking about. And again, that's natural. And you see, like, you have the people who are direct people and then the people who are indirect. And it's indirect not by design, but it's the makeup of the culture. And we are going to get to that. And these loops and zigzags and turns, et cetera, in conversation are all, the static of communication. They also come in the way. So the brain function a certain way, but then we have this additional static. So that's what makes things quite challenging. Now, we were talking about background and foreground. Probably many people have seen this. How many of you have seen this photo? Okay, so what do you see is the classical question. So for those who have not seen this, and this is their first time looking at this, what do you see? Just going, yes, what do you see? Yes, a young woman, and I'm going to outline it with my finger for those who do not see it, because they see something else. This is her chin, her eyelashes, and her wonderful hair, and her coat of sorts.
Okay.
And her ear, yes, you're correct. And what else is there? Yeah, you have kind of almost a witch-looking person, and I'm going to outline it with my finger for those who do not see it. There's the nose, the eye, the mouth. This is still the hair and the coat. You know, once I showed this to someone and they mentioned the buffalo. I never saw it, but I guess now I see it too. And that was an artist, so I don't know if you see a buffalo there. But in any case, again, the point is the foreground, background. We never see the same thing.
Batman.
I'll tell you, yes. So I'm putting this there because I'm originally from Madagascar, and when I saw this, I was shocked. I was surprised. I would say not shocked, but you know, my husband said, yeah, that's Batman. And I said, where is the bat part of this? So I have not been raised in this country, and I've not watched TV with the Batman. Now I know, you know, the music, Batman, wow, pow, etc. And what I see is the yellow part, which are the big teeth. And even now I've got to squint a little bit in order to see the bad part of it. So my background and one's foreground. Okay. Now, this is a little bit of a theory, but at this point, you know, this very famous Dutch social psychologist called Gert of Stetto published a wonderful seminal work about the interactions between cultures. And he created cultural dimension theory because he said that there is a couple of common things in all cultures. Wow, that's interesting because, I mean, that's just cultures are so vast. He has five of them. We are not going to go through all of this, but I'll just explain in very briefly. Power distance is like, you know, in what's the hierarchy level in a society? Is the society, does the society promote equality, or are there our differences okay? Collectivism, individualism. Is the society more towards the promotion of the self, or more interested in the welfare of a society over a larger group? Uncertainty, avoidance. How do you feel about risk? Are you risk prone, or you know, very careful about risk? Is risk something new? Ooh, I'm going to embrace it. Masculinity, femininity. This has actually something to do with are you more like task-oriented or people-oriented, you know, the orientation there. And the Chinese people of the all of the Asian groups said, oh, we need to add something there. And so Hofstetter added, is it like long-term thinking or short-term thinking? So I'm going to just focus on this one because I think the power distance really gives a sense about the other ones. Yes?
I think you're missing the most important. Yes? Creativity.
Oh, creativity. Creativity. And actually, yeah, his cultural dimensions were really were criticized all throughout, even today, because he could not encompass, he could not cover everything. But the creativity comes from, I think, decision making, which I'm going to come up, which is like, wow, I'm looking forward to a little discussion here regarding that. So, you know, why am I going to choose power distance? Because I think that where does the hierarchy in a society come from? I think it comes from the way a society decision-making, ways of making decision originated. So, yes, okay. Okay, so this is just a more definition of power distance. Yeah, we can pass that on. These are all examples. Okay, so I'm going back all the way to these ancient societies, you know, the primitive societies of hunters, gatherers, farmers. And oftentimes, you know, who makes decision in those societies? Usually it's head of families or a group of elders, and they decide about the welfare of the whole community because, you know, that's survival. You need food, shelter, etc. So, yes, so moving into this. So, actually, there were very little differences at the beginning in these societies of hunters, gatherers, and because everybody were about the same, and you do the same thing, and everybody had the same goal of survival, taking care of shelter, of parenting, practices, etc., and passing on that information to their children. Now, I'm going to ask you, you know, you're going to see an image and then after this slide and kind of think like, what are your chances of survival in this type of environment that we see in the next slide? Okay, so the fishermen this time, okay? So think about it. How are you going to survive? You're a group of fishermen. So eventually, you know, from the origin, you know, I said everybody was kind of equal. But eventually, for some community questions, some families delegated decision to a single person, in this case, perhaps this person, or to a group, a little group of people, perhaps these people. So things shifted a tiny bit in this as societies developed. Same here. Now here it's agriculture society. So, you know, water source, if you have rice field, would be at the beginning, right? At top of the mountain or the hill. And if your plot of, if your rice field is at the bottom here, well, I think you better be friends with the people up there who are going to allow you to get some water to for your rice field. So in societies such as this, you know, harmony is very important, the group together, very important. And same with the other society, you know, things will be delegated in terms of decision. So probably the people at the top of the hill will have a bit more power, a bit more decision-making than the ones at the bottom of the hill. So, you know, the thinking goes along those way. But then, you know, as societies grow larger and larger, some individuals decided to make decisions for the whole community. Okay, so let's back up a tiny bit. Yeah. And in some cases, actually, when as societies develop and it was a bit more effective to have a centralized group of people or a central decision maker when you had to take care of big projects or war or you had to manage huge resources. And so that's why I had the picture of the next one. Like if you had to build pyramids, someone needed to organize that. And so there were some leaders emerge who might be individual people helped by another group of people. Yes. Okay, so again, thinking about this, where does power come from? Actually, these are Madagascar, pictures from Madagascar. So whether you're at a more not advanced in war as the other one, they're still thinking about someone that needed to make a decision if you were going to go to war. Next. Same thing here, just to get the thinking going. Okay. In Central or Latin America. Okay. So one gets power, I combined all the photos, because it can be by force, that's war, or by trade, or religion, as we saw in previous pictures, or it might be a combination of all of the of all of these elements. And then the creativity then to try to answer that is like, are the people who want to be creative, who want to be artists, if they're working, I'm thinking about, let's say, the pyramid people who decorated the walls, etc. Were they allowed to do that on their own, or the authority said, no, this is what the pharaoh would like you to do, and that's all you have to do. Or, yeah, it's okay, just go ahead and you can do whatever you want. Whatever you want to draw, it's for the good of society. So that's why I thought about that linkage around there, but of course subject to just discussion. Yes? And collaboration, yeah, because whether you need to work on your own, and that's again, or, you know, is it for the greater good of the society, for these large labors where you need the collaboration of the next village, the next town, the next... Absolutely. In most of the cases, yes. But there, of course, you know, the Amazon, the women warriors, and these are kind of anomalies in some cases, perhaps because of that's to be researched, disease, or all the men were gone, or just like to take something very close here, during the war, for example, when all the men were gone, that's when, for example, in our Richmond area, you develop the Rosie the Riveters. That would not have happened if it were if there were no war, and so they became welders and took roles, and then when the men come back, they said, yeah, we want to continue, and you're totally right, you know, like, and that's where then the differential of power, and then where the hierarchy comes in, so that's totally back. So back up a little bit. This is, I think, important. No, the next one, yeah. Because, you know, like, when those leaders emerged, but in some cases it might have been the priestess, and then some women might have had cases. Oftentimes, actually, in magical religious kind of approach, many women were there. You know, all the Greeks with the priestesses, or in many other societies. But, you know, with the social rank, there was also some duties for these leaders to do, you know, because they had to oversee the production, you know, they had to take care of the development and the growth of the place, and then things developing, they started to have to own fine possession, fine homes, wonderful possession, more than the rest of them, and in some cases they became the links between gods and the living. You know, like I'm thinking of, I don't know, the sun king in France, Louis the 14th, where he was the link between the god and earth. So their stature became larger, and decision, and all of this because of the decision-making process that we saw. Yes. And again, now, in contrast to what we've already seen, again, think about the next, look at the next slide and see what kind of strategies you think would maximize your chances of for survival. Okay, so this is a summary. So you have the farmers, so cohesion is very important here. These are little villages in France. I think in Europe, the villages are so tight, the streets are so narrow because everybody had to be together because you were afraid of all the outside invaders. Strength in numbers, you know, was very important. Harmony was very important because everybody, again, this is for survival purposes. And then next contrasting slide. Now, this geography should look familiar. The west of the now the United States. And yeah, next slide. You know, you have all the cowboy stories and the cowboy riding in the sunset at the end of a movie. So the geography is totally different. Okay. So here they are. So here, obviously, this is where, you know, like one of the cultural dimensions that Hofstetter was mentioning, individualism started to develop or developing. But that's not the only criterion. We will get to additional criterion. Here, what kind of strategies do you need to survive in a very stark environment? And oftentimes it was just a family, or oftentimes you have the lonely cowboy going into the wilderness. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so you had to be tolerant about uncertainty. Certainly you didn't know what was ahead out there. So you had to just have the faith and then just go, because that's where you want to go, where you need to be, and you embrace uncertainty. And so you know, you are open to anything that happens, and you have to rely on yourself. No one is going to help you out there. So that's how, for example, in this particular case, individualistic society developed, for example. Okay? Yeah, so here are just examples that, you know, like everything that we said so far is like how decision-making of societies actually account for some of its cultural values, whether that be equality or risk-taking or motivation, you know, like here to be or to do. For example, if I'm in Madagascar, what does to be mean? Okay, so I just need to give my name. I'm Liliana Khandria Narivunkos. My parents are the Rafid Narives, and my ancestral village is Shomanandran. That's all I need to do. Everybody will know, oh, that's her family, this is it, and I just need to be, and that's it. Okay. Here, you need to know, like Dorothy introduced me earlier, what did I do? You know, I did this, I did that, I did this, the to-do thing. You know, like here, you know, would it matter if I say, perhaps in some of the higher circle, I am the George Soros is my uncle. Okay. You know, he's not, but just saying, you know, like you, the affiliation with your ancestry, that doesn't matter. You have to prove yourself and what you do. Because then that's where the social mobility exists or not in a society, for example. Okay. Yeah, so again, all of this, I wanted to add this for the United, what's now the United States, because of course there was geography, but of course there is the history, to name just another makeup in terms of decision making, the feeling, just the willing to start from scratch to go to a land that one did not even know. That gives a certain approach to your attitude to life, and you have to succeed by your own merit. And then there is also religion. You know, there was a Calvinist bend to the people who came, and there is predestination there. And so equality is very important. And then, you know, from the start, you know, the thing, there were laws established. And so it's not by being, I'm the daughter of and come from this village that matters. It's not by status or by case. It's law. And everybody knows that, you know, the United States is one of the most litigious societies. And, you know, we have laws for everything, for bathroom, for drinking age, for you name it. Because then it's very clear, because it's an equal society, so for everybody, these are the laws. And then we can get into, you know, like in some societies, the laws are like, oh, it depends on the case. Probably you've heard about the case of the pedestrian who was killed. You know, you drive a car and you hit someone, and the person goes to the hospital, but the person who drives the car is your brother. So are you going to apply the law and he's a culprit or what? And then some people will say, oh yeah, he's my brother, and that will save the family. And so are you a universalist or particularist? Meaning that depending on the circumstance, you decide what the situation in this state, in the state, it's very clear whatever the law is, that's what it is. But then we have lawyers who interpret the law whichever way works for the client, for example. So that's just an added dimension. So I'm getting to the conclusion of my presentation here. So we started with the brain, how the brain functions, and we have all kinds of static in communication. We have the foreground, we have the background, and then of course, you know, this is at the core of everything else. What we do is the result of the values that surface to the tip of the iceberg, and that created the way societies are formed. And this is really concentrating it in 2 seconds, really, forwarding the tape, but to give some sense of that. So. Okay. I will give you another tip to help out when we see something. So when we see something, we should not immediately. I think the immediate thing is like, you know, I'm standing here, and the brain does not just stand still. And oh, here she is. Oh, and the shoes are black. Oh, the mind goes, and that's natural. But, you know, like when we see something that's new and that's different and that's unfamiliar, let's describe it first. What is it that I see? What is it that I hear? You know, we have a pathologist friend at UCSF who says, as a pathologist, when I see something, I say, this is what it is. And then other people do the interpretation, but this is what it is, and I cannot change that. This is what I see, this is what I observe, and that's what it is. And then interpret that is the next step. What do you think about it? And then evaluate is the last thing that you do. Same thing, the DIE didn't sound so good, so they changed it to DAE, which is actually the same thing, basically. And it's a Korean word which means all of that, apparently. Okay? Okay, so if you see something like that, yeah, describe, interpret, and evaluate. Don't just say, jump to the conclusion, oh, she's lazy, she's yawning. That's a conclusion, description. She's putting her hand on her mouth. What's happening from there? Okay? Okay, you can move on. And takeaways, you know. We've got a little bit of knowledge now, a little bit of skills through this short presentation. But attitude is the most important thing. Open-mindedness, listening attitude, find a common ground with, even if it's tiny. You know, you see the poster like, here is, we are all here and you are over there. So, you know, the common ground, if it's tiny, that's very important. Okay, and the last one here. I think I've mentioned this. You need to start with yourself. I cannot change you. But if I know, like, oh, this is me, I think these are my benchmarks, and so rather than criticizing whoever out there, I would say, oh, yeah, I need to shift my framework because this is what I think, but, there is another interpretation possibly for that. And I wrote this in gold because I think when in cross-cultural communication, one need to expand your borders and take the best of all cultures and then merge it in a new use.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a fascinating presentation. Wow.